Hey everybody, happy new year. Welcome to the very first OIG Roundtable of 2026. We had a little bit of a hiatus. Wade and Matt got a break for me. Good for them. That was very nice. Got a little bit of a recharge, took a little bit of time off. Back to the grind though. We're back to the grind. So as always, back with Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent charge from the LA field office. Now a director on our SIU investigative team. And of course, Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and our payment integrity senior director, which means that everything comes to Matt. Absolutely everything.
Tan, even rested things, and ready.
Even things that aren't his are coming to him. And of course, I got sick during the holidays, as I do every year, because apparently I'm not supposed to have a good time during the holidays. I'm supposed to just be sick. So we're back in action. And so we want to talk about there was an OIG email that went out a couple of days ago. And it's, you know, it lists enforcement actions and this and that. And there were two that were on there that were pretty similar that are kind of interesting because, you know, sometimes these things, just when you think some of these things have been rectified, they kind of, you know, percolate back. Both of them have a twist to identity theft in some regard. One is a case that was out on December 26th that involved a doctor. Oddly enough, he had previously been convicted for the same thing, stealing the identity of the exact same person for which he was convicted for yet again. So apparently he is a recidivist, and apparently the deterrent factor known as the 3553 factors, that the 3553 factor on deterrence for sentencing did not have an effect on him. And the other one is a January, I'm sorry, that one, that, I gotta look at my notes. That one's January 5th. January 23rd involved a nurse who was involved in, you know, basically an identity theft for the purpose of unlicensed practice of nursing to obtain medications for patients. So Wade, I wanna start with you because what a lot of people don't know is HHS OIG and the Social Security Administration used to be one organization. 1995, they split. HHS went its way. Social Security went its way, created a commissioner, created its own IG. I was hired in 1997, so I missed that fun. But Wade, you got hired in 93, and you were around during that. Matt, you had been on for a few years even before that. So you were both involved in some of the stuff involving Social Security. But, you know, the thing, Wade, that always comes up is SIUs, number one, shouldn't be working these cases, right? So let's talk a little bit about the limits. SIU shouldn't be working these cases, but also how data can help you when you are working these cases, and, you know, the fact that they don't always come in as an SIU case to start.
Right. And we talked a little bit earlier about kind of the two differences in like a case where you have to do your due diligence to make sure that you're not bringing someone on who has these prior convictions. So the one of the most basic steps that everybody should be doing if they have a compliance program, you know, there's like seven elements. The first one being having written policies and procedures. And one of those should be when you're bringing somebody on board, or even if they're on board, you know, occasionally, you know, once a year, whatever it may be, but you should be doing those checks on the LEIE, the list of excluded individuals. I think I'm missing something in the acronym, but it's the exclusion database. So if they've been convicted of something, they should be in that database. So, you know, that should vet out some of these issues, but that's very different from the ID theft, because in many cases, this is a different case where this person was convicted of ID theft, which is, I think, pretty rare, especially if they're doing the same thing with the same identity that they've stolen before. That's an anomaly. But the ID theft type cases won't show up in that exclusion database check. And also just that by the nature of the ID theft, it usually doesn't come in as that being the allegation that it's an ID theft investigation. It's typically a typical case that you would normally, you know, a fraud scheme that is billing for services not rendered, upcoding, or something of that nature. And then after you work up that case, maybe to the end, where you're ready to, you know, do an arrest warrant, search warrant, or something like that, that's when you start finding out that there's an element of identity theft. And frankly, I think the main way that comes, a case could be going on for a year or two, and you don't, you're just assuming that the identity of the provider you're looking at is the true identity. But what usually happens is they start about this time of year, W-2s, 1099s go out, and these providers who are victims of identity theft, they're going to get tax documentation saying they made X number of dollars that they're not aware of, and it's maybe at a different location that they're not aware of. And that's when they start calling the IG and whoever. So I know this is a little bit different from the SIU world, but just to kind of explain how that those are different, and you pretty much have to work up the fraud case before you even realize that there's an element of ID theft involved in the investigation.
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack. So first, you hit the nail on the head. OIG's model compliance guidance 7 points, and an effective compliance plan requires that you do an exclusion check. Now, what's interesting is there's nothing in the Medicare regulations, there's nothing actually in statute that says that you have to do it. And if you actually read the OIG's guidance, it says upon hiring and periodically thereafter. And I think you kind of stumbled yourself with it, because what is the definition? Is it once a year? Is it, you know, when I do some of the consulting work that we do here at Advise, I will tell providers, you should be doing exclusion checks every month. And the reason why you should be doing it every month is because if you hire someone in January and they don't tell you that they've gotten in trouble and they don't get adjudicated until March or April, and for some strange reason, OIG is able to actually contemporaneously exclude them within a short period of time, you have a period of time, if you haven't checked every month, where this person is out there in the wind doing what they are doing, and they're doing it, you know, basically illegally. And so the, you know, doing these exclusion checks every month gives the provider at least the comfort to know that they've checked. And if there is an instance in which a amount of money was paid that should not have been paid, that amount of money is paid, it's 1 month's worth of money versus 6 months, 9 months, or a year's worth of money. And that becomes sometimes the challenge is, you know, you've got exposure, you want to limit that exposure before that exposure becomes onerous, you know, on the person. The other thing that I think you hit on, which is the interesting point, is that a lot of these cases, when they come in, they don't start as an identity theft case. It's a service is not rendered. It's something, you know, whatever it may be. And it becomes an understanding of an identity theft situation after the fact. You've done this investigation. You've done all this other stuff. And that's where sometimes you've got to think in terms of looking at data, right? Like, providers shouldn't have these tremendous spikes. If there's an identity theft, there's probably going to be a huge spike because someone's looking to pump up the bills. You know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, where it comes down to, unless your practice buys another practice or you enroll a whole bunch of people from something else or something, you know, your practice kind of stays flat because your patient base is your patient base. So a lot of these things in the data are going to help you when you're looking at something that's a little bit of an anomaly. How did that anomaly come about? How does a provider who's billing kind of here some level of homeostasis, all of a sudden the claim spikes up over a short period of time? Is there something that's there that lets you say that's a little bit of a situation? And obviously for us, you know, in the non-law enforcement side, we don't have the ability necessarily to get DMV photos, things of that sort. Although some of the services out there, you know, you can get them from some of the, you know, the Accurates and the Clears of the world. You can have subscriptions. Maybe they're getting pictures. Maybe they don't. A lot of these places, you can certainly look to pay for them, but sometimes it's a quick and dirty situation. But Google Photos, Google Images, you can take a photo of someone that you know, you can put it into Google, you can do all of this. Some of the AI tools like ChatGPT, you can put a photo into ChatGPT, it'll scour the internet and pull up other similar images. You know, one of the things that I've been using ChatGPT for lately is I've been using ChatGPT actually as a search engine, because what it's great for doing is you can go and ask ChatGPT to identify things on the internet that tell you XYZ, and it'll give you the links. You just treat it like a Google search engine or a Yahoo search engine versus having it be, you know, an AI tool. So you can use its AI functions for some non-necessarily traditional AI things, which has been very interesting because you're able to find websites that if you're not doing the right keyword search, the AI features can sometimes get you there. And so you're using free and publicly available information for that. But Wade, you know, the piece I want to leave you with is, to a large extent, when you've got the guy from the January 5th case, he had previously been convicted for the same thing, stealing the same provider's information. So the question becomes, when you get an allegation involving some FWA issue involving this provider, like a simple internet search would have brought up, John Smith was previously convicted for stealing Jim Jones or whatever it may be. So sometimes some of these things are obvious, but I still think you're 100% right. It gets back to this premise of that oftentimes when these cases come into the SIU, they're not coming in as an identity theft case. They're coming in as something entirely different. And so, unfortunately, you have to go through those machinations of the investigation, but you still need to do some of this other vetting. And I still think now, like, because this is identity theft is so prevalent in our society and particularly in the healthcare space, it is really incumbent upon investigators or the vetting person or whoever it is that when these allegations come in for fraud and the data doesn't look right, someone should be looking to see, is this provider dead or alive? Is this provider been previously convicted? Is there some issue out there? So there's a lot of collateral things that come into that vetting. But, you know, I think you're right about a lot of these things, is that they don't come in as an identity theft case. They come in as a healthcare fraud case. And so, Matt, that kind of gets to another piece. So you were around at HHS when you had a substantial caseload that included Social Security cases, and mm-hmm. a lot of those Social Security cases were identity theft cases, taking a Social Security number, unauthorized access, that 18 yep. U.S.C. 1028, 18 U.S.C. 1029, misuse of a Social Security number, and the like. But the thing that I think where people oftentimes wonder is, how is it that when a person dies, it takes the government so long to catch up? Because there's a lot of moving parts. It's not just catching up from this, what they call the SSDI, the Social Security Death Index, or the Social Security Master Death Index. It's disseminating out the death of that provider to the payers and all of that stuff. And so there's two pieces, right? You've got ultimately the reporting in to Social Security, which, and I want you to talk about this, is the connection between the Social Security data and Medicare data. They are intrinsically connected. They remain intrinsically connected. And sort of the steps, because it's not like if you die on a Monday, Social Security knows on Tuesday.
Correct. Yeah, it's, you know, this is going back, you know, I started in the late 80s. So it's been around since then that when someone dies, there's no automated system to alert Social Security Administration that someone has died. It is up to the funeral director who's handling the taking care of the body to alert the Social Security Administration. And they get a stipend from Social Security for doing that. But it's a manual process, and it could be days, weeks, months. Sometimes, you know, with things now, the funeral service doesn't take place for weeks or months after someone dies. They die away from their hometown, shipping it, you know, all of that stuff. So it takes time. And then from Social Security, and that just shuts off, you know, if they're a beneficiary, it shuts off their benefits. If they're a provider, it's just telling them, you know, the earnings are going to stop at that point. And then it's got to be Social Security alerts the Medicare system. There's, again, no interchange, at least there wasn't then, between Social Security and Medicare to say, oh, this provider has died, take them off the rolls. It's, again, a manual process, could take days, weeks, months, if ever. It could slip through the cracks completely, during which time the fraudsters know who's died. They're checking the obituaries. They're checking things like that. And they'll see, oh, Dr. Smith has died. They'll look up his NPI. It's still active in MPIS. And they, you know, put in a change of address, a change of EFT to get the check sent to a different place. And they'll start creating claims. And it's a simple process. And like Wade said, it's not going to be until it rises to the level of oh, this is a potential fraud because they're the spikes in the billing or whatever, that someone's going to realize, oh, we got to open this case. And then it could be weeks or months before they realize this guy's dead.
Right.
Why is there still billing for them? And right. at that point, you don't have a case because they're not associated with Medicare, with your plan. They're probably not a participating provider. They're just John right. Smith. So what do you do? You know, yeah, when I was with the UPIC, you went to the provider if they were still alive because of identity theft. You got a statement from them saying they're, you know, a victim.
Right.
If they're dead, you go to their, you know, relatives, get a death certificate, create that, and then you hand it off to the locals because right. it's an identity theft case.
Right. And I remember about a year ago, Florida had a problem with its electronic reporting system. So funeral home directors, it's electronic reporting. They had a problem with their reporting system. And for months, funeral home directors had to manually complete the death certificate. So you just think about like the lag that you have inherently with that, human error that you have with that, and all the other collateral pieces of the puzzle. I remember reading some studies where the estimates on how many deaths go unreported to Social Security, it varied. I think Social Security believes that less than 1% of people that die over a certain age are not reported, but younger people, the reporting is not as good. You know, I think, you know, maybe you never really know the answer to that question, but it's certainly an interesting premise. I think the other piece, Matt, that you brought up, which is the interesting piece, is it's the brokenness of the system. That how do the commercial payers get notified? How does Medicaid get notified? Right. All of these collateral things. And I remember working some check theft cases at OIG where the providers didn't get the money. You know, they have to do the attestation, new checks get issued, and you go through that. And I think, you know, where the government has been able to abate a lot of that was through direct deposit now. Everything is an EDI, everything is ACH. But there's the new iteration, which we experienced working on a bunch of cases here, which is the redirection of electronic deposits, where we would see instances where the bad guys were getting the information for the provider's EFT, electronic funds transfer, and completing a form and sending it. Now, I think, you know, I know we helped several plans with fixing the hole that existed in that, because a lot of that was unfortunately through a third party, that the plans were using third party vendors for some things. And they were just really, they were literally getting a form emailed, please update our EFT. And the third party vendor just said, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then $500,000 here, $1 million there, you know, before you know it, it's real dollars. And when we did a little digging, we realized like, you guys do nothing to vet this. You're receiving an email and no one was bothering to check, is this email a whitelisted email? Is it blacklisted? Is it, you know, no listed? Do we not know who it is to see that? But it does raise the specter that with your, on the payer side, if you are paying money and it's done through EFT, there should be at the minimum a 2, maybe a 3-step process in order to get an EFT changed from one bank account and routing number to another. There has to be a process in place in which there's a multi-level process. Right. You know, who's the person requesting it? Are they authorized? Do we know who they are? Have they been vetted by the payer as an approved person to do it? And then even more so, should the vendor be the one responsible for allowing those payments to be triggered? And I think that becomes the challenge. So
that's an area of vulnerability right there. Someone in the vendor may be complicit with whoever's right. changing the address.
Right.
The other thing is for a lot of plans, let's say Dr. Smith is still alive, gets his identity changed, or gets his identity stolen, someone's billing under the same NPI, the plans are reticent to change the billing numbers. they don't want to cancel the one and give them a new one, because it's, you know, they have one NPI, that's it. And it's difficult to then track, well, who's actually billing this stuff? Is it the real guy, or is it the fake guy? And it's, Social Security is the same way. It's very, very difficult to change your Social Security number if it's been compromised. You're going to have that Social Security number for the rest of your life, unless there's very limited certain circumstances, like abuse, where you've changed your identity, things like witness protection program. So it's the same thing with these identity, with these numbers for the providers. They're very unwilling to change them, and that allows this problem to reoccur.
Right. And so, Wade, I want to go to you for kind of the last piece of this, because, you know, remember a few years ago, CMS changed the, you know, nobody, they, no longer were there what they call HICNs, health insurance claim numbers. It went to the MBI, the Medicare Beneficiary Identifier. It was supposed to be a randomly generated number, not tied to your Social Security number. And the whole point was to treat it like a credit card. In the event that there was an identity theft, you would just flip it off. And we know that hasn't really happened. What are some common sense things? Obviously, from an identity theft perspective, you can only do so much. But, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that I always think of is when someone gets their wallet stolen and they report it to the police, everybody goes immediately to the credit card and banking information. But no one thinks about that health insurance, you know, card. What are some things that people should be doing to keep track of, making sure from the provider side, but also from the patient side? What are some of the things that need to be looked at?
I think a couple of things. One is, I think most people may be a little older, like my age and above. We're still used to writing things down in notebooks and tablets. So a lot of people have, you know, in case their wallet gets stolen, they have all their credit cards with the expiration date and all that written down. So it's easy to cancel all of them. Well, make sure you put your, you know, Medicare beneficiary number on there. And if your wallet gets stolen and you happen to have your Medicare card in there, that's something you probably want to at least check with Medicare. Maybe they won't, like you say, they may not cancel it and issue you a new number, but they can certainly monitor it. And you, as the kind of victim, can monitor it as well. The other thing, I think that, I don't know the specific mechanics of it, but all these two-factor authentications that we have to use in accessing different systems, you know, if you want to log into a system, it's going to call your phone, it's going to ping your phone, it's going to text your phone or whatever, or you have to do that in conjunction with the fingerprint scan. There's all kinds of ways to authenticate access in more than one, you know, dual authentication, two different ways. There probably should be at this point, and again, I don't know the specifics of it, but they should be taking lead on that, where there's so much improvements in two-factor authentication and all kinds of other access that maybe they should be looking, and maybe they are, but some of that same technology, and going back to the physician changing bank accounts or change of ownership forms, that two-factor authentication, maybe it needs to be tweaked a little bit from that, but I think the basis of that could be employed in trying to avoid some of this ID theft stuff.
And I think with technology will come that, but I think that a lot of these technology related things are going to be for the next generation of our older people. I mean, I look at my parents in their 80s. I cannot imagine my father with his flip phone, you know, that he gets 75 minutes a month on or whatever. I could not imagine him having something that involves multi-factor authentication for anything that he's doing right now. My dad is the guy who calls me on his cell phone, says, "Eric, call me back on the cell phone." And then I call him back and it goes to voicemail. And then when I finally get a hold of him, I said, "Dad, you wanted me to call you. Why did your phone go right to voicemail?" "Well, I turned it off." "Well, if I'm calling you, why would you turn it off?" "I turned it off to save the battery."
I mean, they could look at EOBs, right? They get their monthly EOBs, but those are so complex anyway. You know, they might spot, I never saw Dr. Jones, and that's right. And that starts the cycle that Wade talked about. It becomes a false claims case.
I think right. And I think, you know, for both you guys, I know we've talked about this, the biggest challenge on the Medicare beneficiary, but even commercial. I go to the doctor, I get my EOBs, I look at them, and the first thing I do is I say, what on God's green earth is this thing telling me? And you look at a Medicare explanation of Medicare benefits, it's a challenge. Think about someone who doesn't do this for a living like we do, the challenge that they have, right? And that just exacerbates it. So it's interesting to see that these cases still continue to be perpetuated, but you know, at the same time, everybody's trying to build the better mousetrap, right? Whether identity theft comes in the form of a document that's being fraudulently produced, or whether it is just in the stealing of someone's identity online and then just doing things. We see that all the time. You know, right now, one of the big things going on is the theft of houses, right? The deed, the
Deeds.
fraudulent deed transfers and the like getting kicked out of your own house when you own it. So, I mean, these are crazy times, you know, we live in. So to me, what stood out was the fact that we saw in one OIG summary, two cases that were of this similarity, you know, and they're kind of off the beaten path. It's not like we've seen, it's not like it's the eighth case of the week of skin graft or Q codes or genetic testing or any of that other stuff. It literally was two cases involving the potential of identity theft within a week and a half of each other. So it's like, and I know Wade loves it, is this the circus is the same. We've just recycled the clowns yet again. And that's really, I think, what it, you know, what it comes down to. So stay vigilant. I mean, I think people are doing it, and I think the algorithms get better and the data gets better. Think a little outside the box. Think about, you know, if you do have a photograph of your provider, and you do have a photograph of some other things, like how can you make some of these happen without having subpoena power or some of these other authorities that are out there? So we'll continue to look at these kind of cases because they are interesting to us. Particularly, I think the ones where we're seeing the EFT frauds are fascinating because clearly someone has gone in and data mined and gotten that information because they know the name of the provider, they know the MPI number, they know the banking, the routing, but more importantly, they know who the payers are. These are not just randomly, we're sending this out to 50 payers. They're sending these out in a very targeted instance. And I think it's important to be vigilant on those pieces.
I got to run. Thank
Thanks,
you so
everybody.
much.
Hey, all right. Thanks, everybody, for joining this week's OIG Roundtable. Matt's got to go. We'll see you
Bye.
next week. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.